Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in-depth with the most interesting innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 DBSR members.
Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. This week we'll be piggybacking on an interesting conference that's going to be happening tomorrow evening at the UVM Davis Center called Making Dough and Making Change, a Social Entrepreneurship Summit. It's a conference co-sponsored by Ben & Jerry's, Ashoka, and Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. The conference will basically focus around six national thought leaders who'll be talking about what's happening on the leading edge of socially responsible business, where a new breed of social entrepreneurs are starting companies as a vehicle to solve social and environmental challenges. In the first half of our show, we're joined by J. Cohen Gilbert, who is co-founder of B-Lab. B-Lab is a nonprofit organization that serves a global movement to redefine success in business so that all companies compete not only to be the best in the world, but to be the best for the world. Jay, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
So the description there of B-Lab probably does more to leave people up in the air and fill in the blanks. So I'm going to let you fill in the blanks and explain, what does B-Lab do?
Sure. As we look at the world right now, David, it seems like one of the biggest trends that we see out there is the growing recognition that we need to use business for a higher purpose than just making money. And when I say we, I mean a global community of people, right? Whether we wear the hats of as consumers or as investors or workers or entrepreneurs. And the idea is, how do we use business as a force for good, right? Good for workers, good for the communities that we work in, good for the environments that we're a part of. And so B-Lab is a nonprofit that works with business leaders that are using their businesses for that higher purpose. And so the leaders of that more global movement to redefine success in business that you talked about, the leaders of that movement are a group of companies that have been certified as B corporations. The B stands for better, right? Better for their workers, better for the communities, better for the environment. And so just like there are C corps and S corps, there's a new kind of corporation in town, and it's called a B corp.
So let's talk about the problem that you're responding to. Right now, a big company, by law, has one obligation, and that is to deliver profits for its shareholders.
Right.
And if a company is found to be violating that responsibility, well, I guess all kinds of things can happen. Heads can roll. People can be found liable for that.
Right.
So if a company is a B Corp that you certify, that right. B-Lab certifies, what's different?
So they've got legal protection to pursue a higher purpose that they define, right? So the overarching purpose of a B Corp is to create a material positive impact on society and the environment. That's common to all B Corps. And they're legally accountable to do that, which means their shareholders can have legal rights to hold them accountable. It's not just sort of an empty mission statement that hangs on the wall. And they also have to publish transparently for the public an overall assessment of their social and environmental performance that's assessed against a third-party standard. So it's not just sort of a tell the world what you want them to know type situation. And so higher standards of purpose, accountability, and transparency. And so it's more than just a legal problem. Like, that's one of them, David. But arguably, a bigger problem, sort of a cultural problem, like about norms of behavior and expectations. And so the legal thing is just it's just what it is. It's a tool, right? It's just something that you can use. And this is sort of a more useful mousetrap for entrepreneurs that want to serve their communities, not just their shareholders, because it protects them in doing so. But the other thing is, is that it's awfully hard to know who's really walking their talk, right? Because, and Vermont knows this as well or better than anybody, Vermont sort of invented this game, you know, from original conferences on right livelihood to VBSR. A lot of the icons in socially responsible business are born and bred and have grown up and matured and had their own succession stumbles and fumbles here in Vermont. And so a lot of the lessons learned from Vermont are that it's awful hard for the rest of us, particularly as companies scale, to really know whether they're doing what they say they're doing or whether what they're telling us is the whole story. And so in addition to the legal challenges, there's also just a challenge around our ability to determine whether a company is really walking the talk. And so the notion of standards matter, and they matter for whether you're talking as a farmer about organics or fair trade, or whether you care about energy and you're talking about Energy Star appliances, you care about fish in the waterways and FSC certified, you know, forestry or MSC certified fish. And so this is just basically taking that same notion of a certification, but expanding the aperture in our lens. So we're looking at the whole business, not just one particular slice of it.
So give us an example of who are some of the B Corps, certified B Corps in Vermont, and maybe tell us a couple of national brands.
Sure. So I think you mentioned one of the sponsors of your show, an original VBSR member, Ben and Jerry's, is a certified B Corp. King Arthur Flour, 100% employee-owned company, phenomenal company down in Norwich, has been a B Corp since the beginning. Seventh Generation has also been a founding B Corp since 2007. Cabot Creamery, an incredible cooperative, I think one of the largest, if not the largest, producer cooperative in the country, is a certified B Corp. And then there's also, in addition to sort of large national brands like those and consumer products, there's also technology companies like Chroma Technology, or venture investors and law firms like the folks over at Merritt and Moulton, smaller companies, suppliers to some of the bigger companies like Rhino Foods, renewable energy companies like Sun Common. So there's a whole bunch of leaders here, big and small, in Vermont. But what I think they would say they share in common is sort of a Vermont way of doing business. And one way to look at the B Corp movement is a way to codify that Vermont way of doing business and allow it to be easier for entrepreneurs that are inspired by that all around the world, not just in the U.S., but across the world, because now they're B Corps in almost 30 countries. Allow them all to say, oh, that's exactly the kind of entrepreneur I want to be, and here's a roadmap to get there. Here's a legal structure that was created to allow me to do that at scale and hang on to my mission as I bring in outside capital or plan succession. So anyway, those are some of the Vermont leaders that we're following.
Give me a real-world example of one of these B Corps and how they're making use of it and what difference it makes.
Sure. So a company out of Boulder, Colorado, we just had our annual, what we call our Champions Retreat in Boulder last week, where about 300 B Corps from all around the world gathered for a week of figuring out what we could do together that we couldn't do alone. And one of those B Corps is a company called Namaste Solar. And they are a solar company, but they're also a worker-owned cooperative, right? So the folks that install your stuff are also the people that own the company. So as they grow, as the company grows, it's creating economic value for them as worker owners. That company is trying to raise capital in a way that still keeps them focused on their desire to serve the Colorado community. And by becoming a certified B Corp, they became more attractive to and visible to a growing number of private equity investors and venture investors that care as much about societal return on their investment as they do about shareholder return. And so they were able to find an investment more easily that they knew met their high standards for measuring social environmental impact as much as their high standards for being a sound financial investment. And so this became sort of an easy pathway for them to raise mission-aligned capital, as well as a great way for them to continue to engage their worker owners so they know they could hold themselves accountable to the high standards of, you know, not only delivering a beneficial product, but organizing themselves with a democratic governance structure that also sort of increased wide distribution of wealth and democratic governance.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation in the first half hour here with J. Cohen Gilbert, the co-founder of B Lab, which certifies B corporations. B is for better. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. J, a little bit of your background is that you and three of the five founders of B Lab were the founders of a athletic shoe company called And One.
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about And One and the trajectory of your career that led from being going to, you know, be a multi-million dollar athletic shoe company right. to running a socially responsible business.
Yeah. So so And One founded with a bunch of my best friends from, you know, high school and college who didn't wanted to figure out a way not to put on a suit and tie every day and translate our love of hoops into a business. And so at the time, there were great athletic brands, but there was no real basketball brand. And so if Nike was the brand for athletes, And One became the brand for ball players, and more specifically, the brand for ball players who talked a lot of smack but had the game to back it up. And so without being too cheesy about the analogy. We spent our first careers in business building a brand for serious ball players. We're spending the next part of our careers building a brand for good business. And so these are businesses that sometimes talk a bit of smack about how, what good corporate citizens they are, their sustainability practices, but actually have the game to back it up. And just like a ball player backs it up by performing at the end of the day, by performing on the court, these companies back it up through their performance, and they're having their performance validated by an independent third party, and not just about one particular piece of their business, their employee practices, because they're, you know, best to work for in Burlington or something, or they're just their environmental practices, but they're actually being measured about their overall performance, right? So they're from continue the sports metaphor, you know, these companies are sort of the total package, right? It's great accountability, great environmental stewardship, incredibly community-minded, and great places to work for their employees.
So what happened with And One? You started from nothing. What did it turn into, and what became the company?
So bootstrapped, from the floor of a buddy's house, you know, eating ramen noodles, deciding who got the quarters to do laundry. And using our college and bar mitzvah money and mortgage credit cards, you know, to finance early stages of the business. And it became about a $250-300 million global brand that was number two in the basketball category. So we sort of took our turn in the roulette wheel, the turn of the wheel for number two with Nike, and had a great run. And all of us, the five partners in that business, decided about 11 years into the business that it was time for us to move on, that the business faced some sort of structural challenges in a consolidating industry, that it was clear that we either had to be acquirers or sellers. But being a single sport focused niche brand was a recipe for a slow and quite painful death. And so as we looked at each other and the business, it became clear that either we had to double down and say that we're in this for another decade together. We had a refi in the middle there because we had taken on some private equity money in 99. Either we had to double down for another 10 years, and that probably wouldn't, the same five people that were sitting around the table probably wouldn't be there on the back end of that process, and that could be painful. Or we could sell the business, do the best we could in the sale, not only for ourselves, but for everybody that was working for us, both here and overseas, because there were thousands of workers in our factories overseas, and do the best we could for them. But in the context of a sale, and preserve our friendships and say, you know, this is the end of a great chapter in our lives. It's time to do something else. And so we sold the company in 99 to another private company called American Sporting Goods out of California.
How did that sale and what became of your baby, your shoe company, influence your next move here?
So I think the transition from And One to B Corps was already in the works, sort of in the last several years of our time in the basketball business. And it became clear that as fun a place as And One was, and it was a great place to work, and there was pretty wide equity ownership in the company, and there were dogs and kids and fun gym stuff at the office, and we treated our factories really well and had sort of pretty leading code of conduct stuff there. As good as all that was, as we read Double Dip, you know, by Ben and Jerry's, and Take It Personally by Anita Roddick at the Body Shop, and as our sort of the aperture on our lens widened a bit, we realized that And One wasn't, at least I should say for myself, And One wasn't the right vehicle to sort of fully express what we saw as the latent potential for business to be used as a force for good. There were other entrepreneurs doing it far better than we were. And what could we do to both support those existing entrepreneurs, maybe be one ourselves? And what we quickly became clear was the world didn't need us to become another entrepreneur who at best would become another Patagonia or another Ben & Jerry's, who, as great as those companies are, they can't really create the kind of systemic change alone. That sort of social change is a team sport. And if we had one adage at AND1, it was that the best team wins. And so we wanted to be part of a winning team that used business to solve social and environmental problems. And what became clear from talking with hundreds and hundreds of entrepreneurs around the country and investors around the country was that there was some basic underlying market infrastructure that was missing for this emerging marketplace of businesses that we take for granted in traditional consumer and capital markets. And so the standards that we talked about before, the legal framework that we talked about before, some kind of unifying brand to make it easy to signal to a pretty cluttered and confusing and noisy marketplace that these are the companies worthy of your support. And so we decided, instead of being entrepreneurs or being venture capitalists, focused on good businesses, as important as those roles are, that maybe we could play a different role to do some of the unsexy infrastructure building that might help connect those companies and make them more visible to other stakeholders to invest in, to work for, or to replicate, and also to help those companies be more successful in the marketplace by sort of creating sort of a collective brand power that they couldn't have alone. So to give you an example, so there are now, we just started looking at this marketplace in 06, 07. So, you know, the first 18 B Corps were certified in 07. There are now about 830, 840 certified B Corps around the world, 70, 80 different industries, you know, 28, 29 countries, all with this one unifying purpose. And the thing that makes them so powerful is what we experienced last week in Boulder, is you had all those companies coming together, not to come to a conference to figure out what little tidbit they could take home to make their business better, but they were coming to figure out what they could bring into the pot, like a big stone soup gathering, figure what they could bring into the pot to help accelerate the whole movement and make it easier for those that are coming behind them on the trail to walk this path.
So you're essentially certifying socially responsible businesses and giving some legs to what that idea means.
Right.
And so out of this conference last week in Boulder, and just to remind listeners, we're talking to Jay Cohen Gilbert, the co-founder of B-Lab, which certifies B corporations. B is for better, or socially responsible corporations. So what were some of the real pearls that you got out of the conference at Boulder, which I might add, has been in the news, unfortunately, for being the epicenter of a disaster this past week? I imagine you saw a little of the flooding that
we did. Actually, I think one of the most powerful experiences that people had was there were a number of B Corps that were hit pretty hard by the flooding, and not to mention thousands of people. And so we actually responded to that need in the community, and scores of those B Corps that showed up actually went out and did relief work, rebuilding, you know, roads up Sunshine Canyon above Boulder, or helping that company Namaste Solar that I talked about before, who had been, their main office had been completely wiped out by the flood. And so helping them sort of clear out the floor so they can get back to work. Others doing a variety of other sort of service-related things. So there was, we were very much recognizing that we were sort of in a place that was hurting. But the community wanted us to be there, meaning there are about 40 or so B Corps in Colorado who said, please come. And while you're here, see if we can, how can we be useful? And so we did that, which was a pretty powerful sort of service experience for folks. As far as some of the things that people brought out, like the, I think one of the things that showed up for us is that we need to begin to move beyond being a community of businesses to inviting a movement of people to join this effort. And so for the first time now, we're 800 some odd companies. There's 30 plus thousand employees that work for those companies. But there's 20 million people that follow those companies, right? So their social media following is pretty significant, right? Dwarfs what any of those companies could reach on their own. And so the question is, wow, that's a lot of reach. What do we do with that? How do we say that B Corps are not the movement itself? Like, we are leaders of a much broader movement to use business as a force for good. And so while, yes, we'd love there to be not 830, but 1830 B Corps or 8300 B Corps, that's great. But actually, what are the other things we can do to invite other people to join us? And so things like our partnership here with VBSR, where VBSR is using what's called the B Impact Assessment, which is sort of this online free educational tool for any business around the world to sort of create a roadmap for themselves on how to practice a better way of doing business. How do we accelerate those kinds of partnerships and say, look, you may not be interested in being a certified B Corp, like now or ever, and that's fine. But you probably are interested in either taking your first step down this path, or maybe if you've already been walking for a while, you want to figure out how you can go further or deeper or reach higher. And so there's this pretty robust tool that now 15,000 businesses around the world are using. So how can we find other partnerships like the one we have with VBSR that can make that tool more widely available for businesses? And those that want to get certified and join this community can do so. Those that don't, you know, God bless, like they can do lots of great work on their own. Similarly, how can we make that legal form available for companies, whether they choose to be certified? And then lastly, how do we mobilize the 20 million people that are already looking to this business community for their leadership as sort of a positive alternative? How do we give them an opportunity to engage as workers, investors, and as citizens, as opposed to just saying, well, if you're not the entrepreneur, then you're not invited to the party?
So this is an online kind of survey that a business person can do. Is this something that anyone can do by going to your website?
Yeah, so at bcorporation.net, just the letter B and the word corporation all spelled out, .net. And you can go there and there'll be a little red post-it note that'll say measure what matters. And so the idea is that, you know, most type A business people know the number one rule from Harvard Business School, which is we manage what we measure. And so if that's true, then we ought to measure what matters, which is for most people, not just their financial bottom line, but the bottom line of what positive impact they're creating for the people that work there, the communities that they work in, and the environment. So hopefully that they and their grandkids can enjoy it.
What's the tipping point where it makes sense for a company to be a B Corp?
Yeah, great question. So within those 830 some odd companies, you know, there are small sole proprietors and there are large, you know, multinational brands. You know, there are manufacturers and there are consultants and there are law firms and there are venture capitalists and there are tech businesses. And so it doesn't really matter what businesses you're in. What matters is how you conduct that business. And so when you take that B Impact Assessment, when you enter in what industry you're in, how many employees you have, and where you're located, the system will push to you a custom version of that assessment tool, right? So a three-person sustainability consulting firm gets a different set of questions than a large paper mill in the Pacific Northwest. They're all asked stuff about workers, community, environment, governance. But it's really nice that that law firm has things on the bottom of their emails that says, please don't print this email. You know, printing, you know, kills trees. But not really as important as what the paper mill does with its water or timber. And so the environmental questions are both, they're more of them, and they're more heavily weighted depending upon what industry you're in. So it does. The short answer is, there's no time. Like, if you're going to build something that's going to endure, you have to build on a strong foundation. So whether you're a startup business or a new business or you're one that's been around for a while, having the right legal structure, having the right roadmap for the kinds of impacts you want to have on the world, you can do that whether you're big or small in whatever industry.
So of the companies, the 800 and some companies that are B Corps, which one surprises you? You know, some of the iconic socially responsible brands that
right.
we've mentioned,
right.
we would expect 7th Gen, Ben yeah. & Jerry's, Patagonia.
Right.
Who's the most straight-laced
yeah.
surprised?
Yeah, so I hate to call it, worry about straight-laced or not straight-laced, but I think some of the most inspiring stories are the ones you least expect, right? And so there are a couple of manufacturers in the Midwest. I mean, like good old-fashioned, roll up your sleeves, you know, like put down the helmet while the sparks are flying kind of manufacturers. One in Itasca, Illinois, called Solberg Manufacturing. It's a second or third generation industrial manufacturer. They do commercial filters. And they were inspired to join the B Corp community because of another larger manufacturer out of Grand Rapids, Michigan called Cascade Engineering that's got, you know, maybe 8 or 10 different subsidiaries. They operate all across the U.S. They have some European operations, and they do, extruded plastics, right? Not exactly like the hotbed of sustainability. The CEO at Solberg is a guy named Tor Solberg. And what inspires me about him is the incredible sort of Midwestern meat and potatoes, humble sensibility of, he'd be upset if I were mentioning him on the air. So hopefully there aren't too many listeners from Chicago. But he doesn't want any recognition. He's not doing this because it's a cool marketing thought. He's doing it because this is the right thing to do. The guy Fred Keller out of Cascade is also a pretty incredible guy. And so I think those are a couple of folks that really inspire me.
Okay. We've been talking to Jay Cohen Gilbert, the co-founder of B Lab. You can find out more about B Corporations by going to their website, bcorporation.net. Jay, thanks for joining us on this first half hour of the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David.
Looking for a cost-effective way to get your message and image before the public? Then call Always On Time Signs and Designs. They make attractive, well-designed signage in a variety of forms. They offer an in-house design service that is limited only by your imagination. Let's hear from one of their customers.
Hi, I'm Kelly Sullivan. I'm the owner of Splash Naturals, co-owner of Athena's Boutique, and I co-own Ella Boutique in Burlington. They were really easy to work with. They did design it with us. We went and stood over their shoulder and said, well, we want this. No, a little more bubbly. And they just kept working with us until we had exactly what we wanted. They were always on time. They were great. I felt like they had very fair prices, and that mattered as well. And they did a great job.
Call Always On Time Signs and Designs at 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808 for a free client consultation. Located at 115 Industrial Lane in Berlin, Always On Time Signs and Designs, 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808.
AP Update. I'm Rita Foley. The Senate has cleared a hurdle on a spending bill that would temporarily avoid a government shutdown and unravel President Obama's health care law. The vote was 100-0 and came an hour after Senator Ted Cruz ended his 21-hour talkathon. Here's our Jerry Boatlander on Capitol Hill.
Senator Ted Cruz's all-night talkathon against the health care law came to an end after more than 21 hours as the Senate began a new legislative day.
The only path, if we're going to oppose Obamacare, is to stand together and oppose cloture.
While Cruz was applauded by GOP colleagues, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said not much was learned.
It has been a big waste of time.
Senate Democrats plan to advance the House bill that avoids a government shutdown but defunds the health care law, and then plan to strip out the defunding provision. Jerry Boatlander, Capitol Hill.
The fiscal year ends on Monday, and failure to pass a bill would force a government shutdown. I'm Rita Foley.
Music!
Dancing!
Rodwurst!
Beer!
It's time once again for the Stowe Rotary's Oktoberfest celebration. From Friday, October 4th to Sunday, October 6th in Stowe, Vermont, it's a full weekend of fun, including Rocktoberfest, a free rock concert on Friday night featuring the local favorite band, the Sugar Daddies. Saturday kicks off with the Grand Parade at 10 a.m., followed by two full days of authentic German music, food, and great local beer from the Trapp Family Brewery, Vermont's latest microbrewery sensation. No wonder the Vermont Chamber of Commerce named Stowe Rotary's Oktoberfest a Vermont Top 10 fall event. Stowe Rotary's Oktoberfest is October 4th to the 6th in a new location in the Big Tent at the Mayo Farm Events Field. Learn more at Stowe Oktoberfest, that's Oktoberfest with a K, .com. Proceeds from the Stowe Rotary Oktoberfest go to support local area charities and scholarships.
Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow.
And the over 1,000 VBSR members.
Well, Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. The topic of this week's conversation is social entrepreneurship. And the inspiration for that is a conference going on at tomorrow, that's September 26th, Thursday, at the UVM Davis Center, called Making Dough and Making Change, a Social Entrepreneurship Summit. It's presented by Ben and Jerry's, Ashoka, and Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. And for those who might be planning to attend, it is free and open to the public. Starts at 7 at in the Grand Maple Ballroom of the UVM Davis Center. And of course, the most important part is that in addition to starting at 7, it finishes with an ice cream reception, of course, because Ben and Jerry's is involved. We're going to talk in this half hour to two of the people involved in the conference. Cheryl Dorsey is president of Echoing Green, a pioneer in the social entrepreneurship movement. And a little later, we'll join with Sophia Applegren, who is a winner of the Ben & Jerry's Join Our Core competition. She actually is a founder of an organization in Sweden, and we'll hear more from her about that. But first, let's turn to Cheryl Dorsey. Cheryl, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you having me.
Well, the person who preceded you on the show here, J. Cohen Gilbert from B-Lab, was singing your praises as he went out the door and talked about you as a fire starter in the social entrepreneurship movement. So tell me a little bit about Echoing Green, the group that you are a president of.
Well, thank you for the platform. And I should just say that I am part of the J. Cohen Gilbert and B-Lab fan club, so I suppose it's a mutual admiration society. So I do appreciate his kind words. But Echoing Green, which is actually celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, is a global social venture fund that provides seed capital and technical support to some of the world's best emerging young social entrepreneurs. As I mentioned, we were founded a quarter century ago by the senior leadership of General Atlantic, a leading global private equity firm. And they were really quite visionary in terms of being one of the early leaders in building the social entrepreneurship field. We do a variety of things and offer a variety of opportunities for young people to engage in social innovation and social change making, but we're probably best known for our annual global social business plan competition that allows young people from all over the world to submit social business plans. And after a pretty rigorous, grueling due diligence and selection process, we ultimately make about 30 investments a year in the startup enterprises of next generation social change leaders.
Now, you were one of those. You received an Echoing Green Fellowship in 1992 to help launch the Family Van, a community-based mobile health unit in Boston. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm very grateful to have been invested in by Echoing Green 20 plus years ago. At the time, I was in medical school. I was at Harvard Medical School and had taken some time off to go to the John F. Kennedy School of Government to study public policy, and started to learn about the issue of black infant mortality, which is defined as the death of babies less than 1 year of age. And interestingly enough, at the time in the late 80s, black babies were dying at three times the rate of white babies, which is terrible enough. But the fact that it was happening in the shadow of some of the world's best medical facilities really seemed unconscionable to me. So I began working with an obstetric anesthesiologist and the Harvard Medical School professor, Nancy Oriol, and we started to explore, think about, and learn more about the issue, and really came to the understanding that infant mortality was really not a medical issue per se, but was really sort of a manifestation of deeper socioeconomic problems, lack of access to health care, lack of access to transportation, cultural competency concerns. So we developed the Family Van, which is a mobile health unit still in operation that essentially serves as a bridge between low-income residents in Boston and a variety of medical and social services to help improve the life chances of neonates.
Is that van still in existence?
It is indeed. Interestingly, we launched the family van on January the 15th, 1992, on Martin Luther King Day. And that first year, we served 1,292 clients. Today, the van is still in operation, now working in an expanded number of neighborhoods around the city, about seven, serving over 7,000 clients a year. So I'm really proud to say that it's still in existence under terrific leadership.
So give me an idea of what Echoing Green does now and the kind of groups that it's helped support.
Yeah, so as I said, we're probably best known for the annual social business plan competition. So, for example, last year we got close to 3,000 social business plans from 120-plus countries around the world. And working with hundreds of volunteer leaders throughout the world, we set about vetting those social business plans. So from an initial submission of about 3,000 business plan submissions, we will then winnow that field down to about 50 young social innovators that we invite to New York for a pretty rigorous, grueling weekend of interviews. And as a result, we'll select about 30 or so for funding. We invest in these social entrepreneurs, providing them with unrestricted capital between $80,000 and $90,000 over 2 years to help them launch their social enterprises. We provide health insurance, we provide professional development services. Most importantly, we embed them within the Echoing Green network as they try to launch these social enterprises. And I should note for your audience that as an angel investor in the social sector, we are both programmatically and geographically agnostic, meaning we'll invest anywhere in the world, in anyone in the world, as long as we think they are a leader of promise and are explicitly focused on social change. Some of our best-known investments, we were early funders in Wendy Kopp, founder of Teach for America, Alan Casey and Michael Brown, founders of City Year, which is essentially the domestic equivalent of the Peace Corps. We invested in SKS Microfinance, which was the first microcredit institution to go public on India's Stock Exchange, and the fastest-growing microcredit institution in the world at one time. Michelle Obama received funding from Echoing Green to start the Chicago Office of Public Allies, a terrific youth development organization. And collectively, we've invested in about 600 social entrepreneurs from 49 countries around the world, trying to drive positive social change.
So a listener who's out there listening today has a great idea, a way to make a difference. How does it clear the bar of being something that Echoing Green would take note of and perhaps fund?
Yes, that's a great question, David. And, I spend a lot of my time on the road talking to young people who I'm so incredibly impressed with because they want to be on the front lines of social change and really are committed to a path of being a change agent. And what I normally say is I applaud you for being concerned about what's happening in your community and wanting to be a solutionist. But I say, I beg of you, please don't start something new. We all know how difficult it is to launch a startup. We know that most new startups fail, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit, and especially those young people who want to start not-for-profit organizations. The capital allocation is so constrained. There's a lot of duplication in the nonprofit sector. So I say, find that issue you're passionate about, go out and study the landscape, figure out what other organizations are already doing it, and go to work for those organizations or volunteer for those organizations. But if, in fact, you honestly and truly believe that there's not an extant organization that is approaching the problem in a way that can really lead to dramatic progress, then it's time to consider starting something new. So when we look at the applicants for the fellowship, we're looking for the leadership potential. Are they passionate? Do they walk through the world with a purpose? Are they resilient because they're going to fail? Do they know how to get back up? Are they authentic leaders with integrity? Are they going to be able to represent their communities and work with their communities in authentic and real ways? And are they resource magnets? We often talk about these leaders as being sticky leaders. It is so hard to garner resources, financial and non-financial, for your cause. Do we get the sense that these young people are going to be able to mobilize volunteers and media support as well as dollars to make these enterprises successful? So those are the sorts of calculations that we're making, and we often say that the entrepreneur is more important than the business plan. The minute you finalize that business plan, it's already irrelevant because the world is changing constantly. So we're more interested in the leader and their ability to iterate, to think, to be creative, than we are in the business plan. We think that's less important than the deep investment we make in human capital for social change.
Well, people are not born smart and clever about how to do these things. They generally start with a good heart and a good idea. How do you learn to be the kind of person who could succeed in this sort of work?
That's a great question, David. I think, number one, you have to have a humility about the work. I think I have been most impressed and have learned a ton from social entrepreneurs who spend a lot of their time listening and sort of putting yourself in the position to be ever curious, to recognize that you are not you are sitting around the table with your constituents. They are your customers, as opposed to an approach that reminds us of sort of the old noblesse oblige, that I'm deigning to help communities with less than I may have. I think the notion of putting yourself walking in the shoes of those with whom you work and those with whom you serve day in and day out is a really important positional stance to take. I think that's one thing. I think there's also becoming comfortable with not only taking risks, but also becoming comfortable with failure. Again, I'm remarkably impressed with young people today because they really are committed to trying to take on many of the challenges the world faces, but they're terribly afraid to fail, and it brings great shame to them that they think that they could stumble and fall, and they feel they have to do everything right. Some of the best entrepreneurs that I've seen, social entrepreneurs in particular, are really open to this notion of sort of falling down but getting back up and really taking the time to mine those failures and to figure out what were the lessons they were meant to learn as they continue to build an enterprise, to build a social movement around the problem that they care about. So I think those are some of the factors that have allowed the social entrepreneurs in our community to really succeed.
And I see on your website, echoinggreen.org, you have a program, Work on Purpose, that perhaps conveys some of what you're describing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, we're really proud of Work on Purpose. It's a fairly new program relative to the fellowship program, and was started about 4 or 5 years ago. As Echoing Green went out into the world to talk to young people, we realized that, you know, there were so many young people who wanted to be engaged in social innovation in the field of social entrepreneurship, but the vast majority of them were not necessarily social entrepreneurs, did not want to start a new enterprise. But the question became, how do you engage with these millennials, with these young people who want to be involved but want to do it in a different way than starting a new enterprise? So basically, looking back at our 25-year history as a social innovation funder, we put together a set of 10 competencies that allow us to talk to young people through workshops, through panel presentations, to basically work with young people to help them identify their purpose and to put it into action through their professional and personal lives. And I won't go through all of the competencies, but I'll just, you know, give you one example. One of the competencies that we talk a lot about is asking young people to collapse the divisions between the head and the heart. And we have a formula here at Echoing Green that we talk about all the time, and it is as follows. We say head plus heart equals hustle, that you cannot disconnect your brain power, your analytical mind, from your heart and soul and what feeds you and what fuels you. And some of the most successful social entrepreneurs in our community have figured out that beautiful alignment between their head and their heart to walk through the world in very intentional, impactful ways. So Work on Purpose is all about providing that space for reflection and thinking for young people as they go out into the world, whether it's as investment bankers or as second grade teachers or the few who become social entrepreneurs, and to help them develop the kinds of skills and frameworks to put their passion to use in making the world a better place.
Okay. Well, Cheryl Dorsey, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David.
Cheryl is the president of the Echoing Green, the Global Social Venture Fund. And our final guest, she will be speaking tomorrow night at a conference at UVM called Making Dough and Making Change, a Social Entrepreneur Summit. It's at 7 o'clock at the UVM Davis Center. We're finally on the Vermont Conversation. We're joined by a guest from Sweden, Sophia Appelgren. Sophia, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much, David. Nice to be here.
Well, you've come a long way, and I understand you are the winner of the Ben & Jerry's Join Our Core competition. Explain what that is.
It's a competition for social entrepreneurs, and we have in Europe. And I just want to make clear that I am one out of nine winners. So we are totally nine winners here in Vermont this week. And it's all about, actually getting your idea, vision, and your business model confirmed, and get feedback on how you will scale your organization in the future. But it's also, we win 10,000 euros that we will be able to invest in our organizations. And great, great insights this week from Ben & Jerry's about leadership, about values, about how about living, what you learn. So there is about, a lot of things that is extremely valuable for us. And why I joined was because many of us who are here this week want to launch our ideas in new countries. And the jury was international and representing the nine countries. So it was very, very valuable to get their feedback and insights at your idea and business model and values, of course. So,
well, tell me a little bit about your organization in Sweden, and I'll let you pronounce it since my Swedish is not so good.
Yeah, it's Mitt Liv. Mitt Liv means my life in English, and the Mitt Liv is for-profit social enterprise. And our objective is to increase diversity and integration in the Swedish labor market. We know that the world is changing, Europe is changing, and Sweden is changing, and people are moving increasingly in the world. And in Sweden today, we know that, and as it is in many countries, of course, that finding work is the key to positive integration. And in Sweden, in 2015, 27% of the Swedish population in the ages between 18 and 65 will have foreign background. But we also know that in our country, it takes almost 9 years for a woman of foreign descent from the time she arrives in Sweden to finding employment, and approximately 7 years for men. So very basically, what we do is that we have created a mentor program for those people that come to Sweden who have an academic degree. And we match them to mentors comparing competence within the organizations that we cooperate with. And so that's the target group. That's the core of our organization, this mentor program. And then to finance this program, we work together with some of the 27 largest companies in Sweden today. And we provide tools and methods and and help them and support them with their strategies, diversity strategies, and they pay for this, and they also offer mentorship within the organizations that is bring back to the mentor program. So, well, that's very basically what we do, and we have a long-term objective. I founded the organization 2008, so it's the sixth year this year, and we're facing a lot of challenges in our country, but also with this kind of organization that is not so very mainstream, I would say, not in Sweden.
No, so you work with immigrant girls to help them into the labor market, and I read that you are looking for immigrants with what you call true will.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, what we need to do is to bring out the positive and driven ambassadors. True will, it's more about if you really want to do this, because this is something that you do in your free time. And if you are driven, if you want to make a change in your life and start working against a job close to your competence, then this is the program for you. So, and I want to make clear that it is not only girls, it's women and men with an academic degree. Because what we see today is that the companies, the global companies that we work with, they go to other countries to recruit the people that we have in our program. And that is a loss economically, but even for the individual in our country to not get that chance to a job. So,
what made you want to do this work?
Wow, that's a good question. I think it's a combination of different things, but my curiosity for the world and for differences and my experiences from times in life when diversity or different people with different skills and different perspectives are the most creative is the key for this, I think. I think so many people miss us so much because they do not open their minds and let the curiosity lead them forward and not fear. So in many ways we fight prejudices by creating those meetings between people from all around the world in our country and help them to understand how diversity and differences and perspectives can bring things forward. So
did you have your focus on helping immigrants, did you have some experience, personal experience, either as an immigrant or working with immigrants that inspired you?
Well, my husband he's got roots from Turkey. And since 14 years, I've seen very closely how the Swedish labor market works and how not including or excluding the labor market actually not always that you are aware of it, but there are things that how do you say limit people from getting the same chances as if you were born in our country. So that's absolute and experiences. And we have a huge family in Istanbul and kids who are actually raised in a family where we used to talk about picking the raisins from the cookie. We pick the best things from our both worlds, and that's what we do actually in our program too. We pick the best things from all parts of the world.
Is there a story of somebody who you've helped through MitLiv that stands out in your mind of what the possibilities are for you?
Yeah, we have so many individual amazing stories. This is actually what you know, gives us our energy every day we come to work. It's an email, a phone call of someone who has been struggling for years to get a job and suddenly through our network gets it. So, for example, this year we have a woman from Somalia and she is so well educated. She's got an economic degree in Sweden and she was struggling for a job for 5 years. And she got a job at one of our partner companies. And this year she will be a mentor in our program. So that's when the circle is closed.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll finish. Sophia Applegren, founder of MitLive, a social entrepreneur in Sweden. Thanks for joining us on this week's Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And
bye-bye.
That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. If you're around tomorrow, Thursday, September 26th at 7 p.m., you can go for free and open to the public the conference Making Dough and Making Change, a social entrepreneurship summit sponsored by Ben & Jerry's, Ashoka, and VBSR, where some of the guests on today's Vermont Conversation will be speaking there as well. And tune in next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for the next Vermont Conversation.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Extremely low frequency, or EL.